This program is brought to you by Joule, sous vide by Chef Steps. Joule takes the guesswork out of cooking. Learn more at chefsteps.com/joule. I'm HRN's Executive Director, Katie Mosman-Wadler, with a preview of the next episode of Meat and Three, our weekly food news roundup. The topic? Restaurants and rules. Some rules are based on religion.
This makes for an unusual scene in a Manhattan restaurant. A shy 20-year-old dictating the kitchen standards to a humble veteran chef.
While other rules promote health and safety.
But who are these feared rule keepers with the power to shut a restaurant down?
They're not really like food lovers.
Some restaurant rules fall outside the domain of the kitchen.
All civil rights issues have basically, at one point or another, revolved around the bathroom.
For more, tune in to this week's Meat and Three on Heritage Radio Network, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hello and welcome to Why Food, a podcast about entrepreneurs, innovators, and career changers who have moved from other industries to make the food world a better place. I'm your co-host, Ethan Frisch.
And I'm your co-host, Jenny Dorsey.
And
I'm calling in today. Oh, sorry, Ethan.
No. I was going to ask you why you're calling in. Why are you leaving us alone in the studio?
I know, I'm very sad. I'm calling in because I'm in the kitchen today prepping for a big event I have tomorrow. I've been doing a project this year called Asian in America. It combines virtual reality and food and drink. And it's a 6-course kind of like symbolic exhibit and event that explores the Asian American identity. So we've been touring the U.S. In different museums. And tomorrow we have an event at the Museum of Chinese in America here in New York. So I'm heads down just trying to get the last of my prep stuff.
What are you making?
So unfortunately, lots of stuff. But right now I'm sous-viding a bunch of veal sweetbreads that I have to press overnight with an herb called the rice paddy herb. It's very popular in Vietnamese cooking, as well as culantro, not cilantro, and some garlic chives.
Sounds delicious. Where can our listeners learn more? I feel like this is a question we always ask our guests. Where can our listeners learn more about your work?
Yeah, well, you can always find me at Chef Jenny Dorsey on Instagram. So I talk about that event a lot. And then the official landing page you can find at studioatao.org, which is my nonprofit that hosts these, / Asian in America, with hyphens in between Asian in America.
Cool. So now to the reason that we're here for our regular show, in addition to Jenny's really awesome work. We have a really cool guest for you this week, somebody who I was having such a good conversation with at the Heritage Radio Network Gala earlier this week that we just, like, I don't know, felt like we had to continue it on the air because obviously we both have such interesting things to say that the whole world needed to hear them. No, I mean, I think there's a lot of relevant and interesting topics. So we're joined by Haley Barron, who is the City Operations Director for the Pineapple Collaborative. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, guys. I'm super excited to be here.
So you do a lot of things. And in just before we start, we turned on the mics. I asked you what your title was, and you said it's complicated. So why don't we start there? Tell us why it's complicated.
It's complicated because I've spent pretty much the last 6+7 years freelancing, contracting across the food system. So right now, most of my time is spent as the City Operations Director for Pineapple Collaborative. And just a quick promo on what Pineapple Collaborative is, if you guys don't know. We're a community of women who love food. We're across the U.S. and abroad, but mostly in the United States. We are in real life in San Francisco, D.C., and here in New York, and online through a couple blog series and, of course, on social media. And we actually have our own podcast called Pineapple Radio, based out of D.C., and Full Service Radio, which is a Jack Inslee radio station, which is the old executive producer at Heritage. So anyways, that's Pineapple. My role with Pineapple is overseeing all of our operations across our cities. So I oversee our programming, our ideation around events, our staff, our strategy, all of our logistics, and making sure everything's happening. On the side of that, I also oversee a citywide evaluation of a food access program that is administered by the mayor's office and Barbara Turk, who is our food policy director here in New York. And what we're doing is we're effectively like third-party auditors, where we're coming in to see whether or not this pilot program called the Healthy Savings Program is working. And so my team and I have conducted a pre-survey to understand the shopping habits, food consumption habits, and food security status of around 7,000 New Yorkers who are receiving this program, this benefit card. And we interviewed around 700 of them at the beginning, and now are following up with them 6 months later to understand those changes and see if the program has worked. And then on top of that, I recently...
As if that wasn't enough. Yeah, all right.
It's like comma, pause. I recently finished a master's in food studies at NYU, where I focused on food systems and particularly the supply chain. And so I did a national analysis of the organic supply chain, where I heard from around 500 organic handlers, which is something we can get into later, which effectively that the distributors, the manufacturers, sometimes the farms, who are literally handling the food. So they're not just growing it, but they're in some way processing it, even if that means they're putting a 1,000-pound tote of rice into 1-pound bags, they're handling that product. And so they also have to be certified by the USDA. So I wanted to understand the ways that those organic handlers were working directly with growers to better support the organic industry and better support the growing operations. So I'm in the process of writing 4 papers with my professor, Carolyn Dimitri. We've put 2 out into the world and waiting to hear back from a couple journals to see whether they'll get accepted. And we're just in the process of starting 2 more.
And do you see interaction or overlap between those what seem on the surface to be pretty different things that you're working on?
Absolutely. I think pineapple is the best confluence of everything I've done, because really what it is our programming, our content, everything that we're doing is related to all things food. And I sort of act as this food justice, food systems wing of our organization, of our company. And we actually, all 3 of us at Pineapple HQ have some kind of environmental or food systems background, but that's really my passion. And so I'm constantly finding ways to incorporate those types of topics, those types of questions into our work. For example, if you're in San Francisco, we have an event coming up December 17th that's called Food for Change, where we're going to be talking about the ways that food affects policy, policy affects food, but also the ways that our audience and our community of women in San Francisco and beyond can get more involved in food system. So that's like the main way, I'd say. Yeah.
And Jenny, if you want to jump in, just interrupt me, because usually we can see each other
right.
across the
you
table.
Have eye contact.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. Well, I really want to ask some questions about the healthy eating program with the mayor. Like, what were some of the questions that you were asking? It's so much like it's quantitative and qualitative. What were you asking them when you did the pre-survey? And now how can you see if they have changed? Because I know, you know, healthy eating is a sensitive topic, and sometimes people might fudge the truth a little bit about their eating practices. Like, how do you kind of bypass that or, like, get to the bottom of things?
Yeah, definitely. So it's called the Healthy Savings Program because how the program works is that you get a benefit card where you get $10 of matching funds every week to use at certain grocery stores on fruits and vegetables. And those matching funds allow you to get, me as a recipient, I would go and spend $10 and then I get $10 for free. So in terms of the qualitative quantitative piece, I think that's what like the most interesting part of your question for me, because we are doing we're doing qualitative research in that we are sitting down with someone at their health clinic or their food pantry across the city, across the boroughs, and we're asking them, like I said, about their food consumption. So what they're eating, we're asking them very specific questions, such as how many green vegetables are you eating on a weekly basis? We're really getting specific, and then, and of course, again, there is some level of estimation there or guesstimation, but we really work with them to understand what types of vegetables we're talking about, and that when and where. So we ask them about where they're shopping and how often. We ask them questions that are called, they're called validated questions, which is a term effectively meaning that questions are, they've been asked so many times, but for these questions by the USDA, that they're validated as the correct format of the question to get the answer requested.
What kinds of questions are those?
Those are mostly food security status questions. So those are questions like, on a monthly basis, how often do you or other adults in your household cut or skip meals? Or how often do you have to eat less than you feel like you should? So those are not the exact words, but they're literally our exact wording where we cannot change the wording because they're validated. And that allows us to look across data sets and ensure that a question we're asking in our city here could potentially be compared to other surveys that are using that same question. It sort of ups the ante of the question.
Were there answers that you were particularly surprised by or results in the survey that...
Well, we're just in the middle, so there are no answers yet because we've only done our pre-survey and are about halfway through our post-survey, which is done 6 months after the pre-survey is done, and we're doing all those by phone. So our team is out. We have a team of four who are out and about on the phone chatting with New York residents in English and Spanish. And I think one of the biggest learnings, and again, this is anecdotal, off the record anecdotal.
Off the record on the mic, yeah.
Off the record on the podcast. That, you know, I think one of the learnings, and this is more through the process of interviewing people and chatting with people about their usage, is that money isn't always the only predictor of whether or not you're going to eat a certain way or you're going to buy certain ingredients or items at the grocery store. And what I mean by that is there are a lot of other factors that we... That exists in our world and in our lives that have nothing to do with money. So you might be in a low income household, but you also might be really, really far from a grocery store, or you might really, really love a certain kind of food and really, really hate a certain kind of food because that's how you grew up, or your kids might really, really hate a certain food. So why are you going to buy it? And because they're getting something at school or at their friend's house or wherever. And so there are just so many other factors at play. And so while I think it's really important to do this study and have this program, this pilot program, to see whether or not it is effective in our city, I'm willing to put some money down on the fact that I think one of our learnings may be that incentivizing through money isn't always the only predictor of healthy eating and fruits and vegetable consumption.
What's the process after the survey is completed, converting these results into policy, making changes along the lines that the survey's indicated?
So well, first they go to our team. Most of the analysis will happen through my professor, Carolyn Dimitri, and her collaborator, Lydia, and myself. And what we'll do is we'll analyze this data to understand that pre and post. So as part of also the post survey, I didn't mention this before, we'll ask questions like, I mean, they're pretty simple, but things like, was it difficult to travel to the stores that were part of this program? So that we can better understand some of the challenges that people had, or how often were they using this card? So not just those set questions that we ask in the beginning and set questions we ask at the end, but we'll add on additional questions. So because of that, because we'll have that data, we'll be able to write a report for the Office of the Mayor and Barbara Turk, the Food Policy Director, to say, here are suggestions of the ways that this program is and isn't working. It is really up to them to make those decisions in the end. We are, again, the third-party auditors. We are the evaluation team. We don't work in the mayor's office, we are NYU employees. So that, I think, it's really up to the city then to make those decisions.
That always, for policy making, it always sounds like, you know, there might be a lot of data or good intentions on what they do, but a lot of times it's like the eventual execution is complicated, to say the least. What do you think would be, in an ideal world, what would you like to see happen out of this research? And what do you think are, good next steps for the city to take?
Yeah, I mean, I think, it is a pilot program, so there's always going to be challenges. I think there is opportunity for the city to expand to different grocery stores. Right now, we just work with a couple mm-hmm. grocery stores and then specific ones within that. And that's been a challenge for the clients of the program. And so I think that broadening the scope there would definitely help the accessibility and usability of the program.
Yeah.
Let's sort of zoom out for a minute and talk a little more about your career path. We dove right into this serious policy stuff, which I love. How did you wind up doing this? You've bounced around. You've had a lot of interesting jobs, and I think all different from many of our guests who have done something radically different, not worked in food at all, and then made a pretty hard switch. Where you've cobbled together a really interesting assortment of jobs across the food system. So tell us a little bit of that story.
I know, it's funny when you guys asked me to do this, I was like, you do know that I've always been in food, right? I'm not technically a career changer.
Well, but in so many different aspects of
food. It is an alternative road.
You're very edgy journey. For our podcast, right, I think is edgy, the moral exactly. of the story.
Yes, exactly. Anyway, so my whole world has always revolved around food. I was one of those kids who wanted to eat the weirdest things and always really cared about food. And when I was young, growing up in San Francisco, I very quickly recognized the income disparities that exist in San Francisco pretty much said to my parents, hey, I want to know more about this and why there are people sitting on the street and what's going on. And so when I was about 9 or 10, I started volunteering at St. Anthony Foundation, which is what we call community dining room, which in New York we call soup kitchen. And what I did was I started going there, not too many times, but a handful of times a year. And then over time, it ended up being immersion programs where I was there for a few weeks. And then it was internships throughout high school. And very quickly, I realized that my whole focus was on social justice and anti-hunger and homelessness. And so that brought me through all of high school, all of college, really my whole world was social justice. And it landed me in D.C. at the at an organization that was doing food research, and I was doing a bunch of research that I was super excited about, but the summer ended, and that was my position, and so I ended up at the Capital Area Food Bank in D.C., and what I was doing there was teaching nutrition and cooking education, and I very quickly realized that the food world was much larger than just the anti-hunger and food access work that I had been doing. And so my personal interests of nutrition and knowing where food came from and cooking suddenly became part of my professional story as well. And so after about a year of that, I started to farm part-time and sell food at the farmer's market and test recipes. And
what were you growing?
I worked for a diversified CSA, vegetable CSA in Maryland. And so we grew certified organic. I don't remember the number of varieties we grew, but it was somewhere in the 100. And so it was a really intensive small scale, but I was able to pick up all of these different skill sets across the food system, and it was purposeful. I mean, people thought I was crazy because I was somewhere different every single day, and I was working, 6+ days a week, and what that meant for me was that I was able to pick up on little pieces across the food system rather than diving deep into one, and that breadth was sort of like an interdisciplinary career choice where I was able to bring something from the food bank where I was still working part-time to the recipe testing kitchen, to the farm, back to the farmer's market, and in a circle. And so those positions sort of started to develop. I took on some research with a small consulting firm and did some feasibility studies and tried to understand the institutional buying from farms and did a lot of different pieces. And then it brought me to New York, where I started a master's in food studies because I really wanted to continue that interdisciplinary piece of the puzzle. I just feel like the best way to understand a system as complicated as our food system is to know as many pieces of it as possible. There are many I do not know. That is for sure. But that was sort of my take. And since then, I've farmed more. I've done sourcing. I've done a lot of evaluation work, research, et cetera.
Do you feel like there are particular aspects or areas of the food system that are almost always overlooked or ignored?
I think one that has a lot of interest from consumers, but less interest from investors, which is something that's really interesting to me, is the organic supply chain. And I think we'll probably get into that more later. But right now, there's a lot of dollars going, VC dollars specifically, going into...
Venture capitalist investor
sorry,
dollars.
Sorry.
Just keep going, keep going.
venture capital dollars and just investment dollars in general going into the sort of ag tech space. And most of that space is related to indoor growing or soilless growing. There is some going into on-field or in-field growing, or, you know, there's technology that's being used in-field, but most of it's going inside. And I think there's a hugely missed opportunity when it comes to reevaluating our food system, because most of our food system, the way we eat, is in ground, it's soil. And so if we're spending, I always say, like, if we were spending a fifth of the dollars that we do on the indoor growing, on understanding our soil health and biodiversity and organic growing systems and how we could grow with at least fewer, if not zero, pesticides and fertilizer, chemical pesticides and fertilizers, we might actually be able to affect change in our food system. So I would say that is sort of like the opportunity, at least I think that's missing right now.
I do also want to ask about organic, and I think I like to think that I'm vaguely, like, educated on organic versus non, but at the same time, I think a lot of people are confused as, like, what exactly organic entails, since I think the spectrum of what can qualify for organic has kind of changed or maybe expanded over the years. Could you just kind of talk about what that trajectory has looked like? What do you think? Is there, like, a true organic that's truer than other types of organic? Does it matter if a farmer is using, not spraying and all of that, but he doesn't have the certified organic label? How do you find those people, and kind of like how that dynamic works also with the USDA organic label?
All right. Well, there are a lot of questions in there.
Yeah, I
know. No, it's great. It's great. I think that let's start with the sort of definition of organic and what it really means. Organic is a term that it's actually a legal term. It is in the law from 1990, but didn't actually go into effect until 2001, 2002. And so just keep that in mind in terms of its lifetime as a national federal policy. But really what it is it's a term that is defined by legislation that is administered by the USDA. And what the law really says is that there are certain ingredients that cannot be used in an organic farm or in an organic product. And those products, generally speaking, are synthetic fertilizers, pesticides, which includes herbicides, fungicides, etc. There's no antibiotic use in any animal production, and there's no GMOs. So all of that is, like, at the minimum. None of those things are allowed. And I think that's like one space of uncertainty for a lot of consumers. They don't see the no GMO label, but they see organic and they think, oh, there's GMOs. That's not true. There must be antibiotics in here. If antibiotics are used on an animal, the animal is taken out of production, whether that's through a dairy or through meat. So that, I think, is sort of like the basis. Within that, there's some wiggle room. There's some gray area. There's something called the National List, which is a list that's run by the National Organic Program. And there's an advisory board that decides what's on this list. And the list effectively says, here are ingredients or products that can be used in organic that are synthetic, and we're going to allow them to be used because they're not commercially widely available across the U.S. So my favorite example is hog casing. So there is not an efficient or sufficient amount of hog casing.
What's hog casing?
So when you eat a sausage or a hot dog, there's something on the outside that has a really nice bite to it, and that's hog casing. It's the intestines of a pig. Was that good enough?
Yeah.
Great. Okay, good.
Yeah.
And a really traditional method for stuffing sausages. It's not like an industrial or new addition to this product.
No, like ancient and totally normal.
Okay.
So there's not sufficient supply of certified organic hog casing that can be used to supply the demand for organic sausage. That means that the National Organic Standards Board, this board I mentioned before, decided that the sausage industry can use non-organic or conventional hog casing to make organic sausage. So that's an example.
Fascinating.
So there are a lot of those.
So why is that significant?
But
because when you eat an organic sausage that's labeled organic, that has a USDA seal of organic, you would assume that everything in there is organic. But what the organic label says truly is that it has all those minimum requirements I had mentioned with some exceptions. And I think that's where the consumer gets confused. And I totally understand that. Another one, there's not enough organic pectin. So
pectin is the thickener in jams.
There can be conventional pectin used in organic jams. So I think for the consumer, it's understanding that organic is for, at least, and also for me personally, organic is our minimum requirement. It's not the best, and it's definitely not the worst. I always say I'd rather have someone overseeing the process of how my food is grown rather than no one. And so it means that at least we're not getting all of those additives that I had mentioned, the pesticides, the fertilizers, the antibiotics and the GMOs. Again, it's not perfect. And I think, like you were saying, Jenny, there's a lot of confusion. There's a lot of new movements also around organic that include things like regenerative agriculture and biodynamic agriculture and organic plus, and people who have decided not to go organic, which you also mentioned in your question. So there is a lot of nuance in this. But I think that for the consumer to remember that most of these farms that are growing organic they're following the rules. They have oversight. And it means that they're not using all of those synthetic chemicals that I had mentioned.
We're going to take a quick...
It is also kind of a... Oh, sorry.
Jenny, do you want to go ahead and we can ask the question after the break? Or you want to...
I'll ask after.
Okay.
All right. Well, we're going to be back in 2 minutes with a fascinating question from co-host Jenny Dorsey. Stay tuned.
This program is brought to you by Joule Sous Vide. My name is Katie Mosman Wadler. I am the executive director of HRN and a real-life Joule user. When you cook with Joule, there's zero guesswork, so steak, chicken, seafood, turkey, vegetables, and eggs all come out exactly the way you like them. The Parrot app is intuitive to use and preloaded with all the recipes you'll need, and it has a great visual doneness guide. Joule is awesome for holiday cooking. It's easy to cook for a crowd, and it's perfectly precise, so you can focus on entertaining without worrying about checking food temps, while Joule does all the work. You can try out new cuts fearlessly. One of the best things I ever made sous vide was a juicy, tender heritage goose with juniper berries, and it was life-changing. And pro tip, Joule is small and packs easily, so you can sneak it along on your holiday travels to be this season's food hero everywhere you go. With Joule, you get perfect food every time. To get yours, visit chefsteps.com/Joule and use code HRN as in Heritage Radio Network to get $15 off for a limited time. That's chefsteps.com/Joule, code HRN. And happy holidays from all of us at Team HRN.
And we're back. Jenny?
We have Haley Barron today from the Pineapple Collective. Thank you so much for joining us, Haley.
Yeah, of course. And this is a totally honest. Totally honest mistake. Pineapple Collaborative. You know, everyone thinks it's collective. I'm not quite sure why.
I say collective?
No,
I'm sorry.
You said collaborative. You're good. You're good.
Oh no, but I'm just, sorry.
Don't worry. It's interesting. Everyone does that. All right, I'm ready for a
it
question.
It is a collaborative and a collective.
It is,
like
yes.
A collective collaborative.
So we were talking about organic stuff.
Two questions. Well, one, on the organic note, when you mentioned there's not enough cod casing for sausages, like would there ever be an option instead of saying, let's just go for conventional cod casing, to say, perhaps we shouldn't be producing so many sausages. Is that ever going to be an option, or is it kind of like we just have to kind of do whatever it takes to meet the current demand supply, especially in the wake of like the vegan movement trying to eat less meat? So that's question number one. And then two, I was going to ask about biodynamics, since we actually had the wine manager at Olmsted a few weeks ago, and she was talking about biodynamic wines and wanted to hear more about if there's similarities, differences in how biodynamic farming is with biodynamic wine production.
All right, so we'll start with that first one. You pretty much nailed it. It's based on supply and demand. So if consumers were to stop buying sausage, then
so much sausage.
then there would be less produced. But
a PSA to all Brooklyn organic sausage eaters to stop eating sausage. Is that the answer? No.
No, I mean,
scale back.
Right. Yeah. I would say probably step number one is to choose organic. Or actually, really, I'd say step number one is to choose organic and or know where your food comes from. And that's another thing that we can get into. But I think that, you know, if something isn't certified or you're feeling frustrated with the confusion around the hog casing, go to the farmer's market or the green market and talk to your farmer and chat with them about how they grow their food. And you can chat with them about their hog casing. Anyways, now I think that's enough hog casing.
I think any farmer at the green market would be thrilled to have a shopper come up and ask where their hog casing comes from. I feel like I have seen sausages, organic sausages in sheep casings, or I guess other, I don't know if this is a thing or just something I've observed in very select cases, but
totally plausible.
Using other animals to encase your sausage.
Again,
meat.
It comes back to supply. So like we're talking large scale manufacturing, there isn't enough sheep casing for usage to meet the demand.
And do you think is it really an absolute lack of supply, or does it have to do with distribution within the supply chain?
I think it has to do with that as well. In the conventional market, you have very large scale producers, distributors, manufacturers. So that means that you have aggregation of any product. We don't have to stay in hog casing. And that means that it's all in one place, where the organic industry is much smaller, the producers are smaller, the manufacturers are smaller. There are some big guys in there, don't get me wrong. I mean, General Mills is an organic handler, so they're processing organic foods as well. And they either contract with or own processing facilities. But generally speaking, the organic industry is smaller. I think it's now 4 or 5% of food sales. Oh God, I hope that's right. my professor's gonna be like, "You got it wrong." But so the point being is that the organic supply chain is quite small in comparison, and I think a big part of that is decentralization of processing. Because as many of us know who think about food, is that especially in the meat industry, and this is really not my total expertise, but you know, we talk about the meat industry and how consolidated it is, and that's mostly in the conventional side. The organic side is more decentralized. There is becoming more consolidation, but it's not nearly as bad as the conventional market. Okay, your other question was about biodynamic. Okay. And biodynamic in wine. So I know very little about wine. We actually, our most recent Pineapple New York event was on natural wine. It was awesome. So we did get into biodynamic wine growing. When it comes to biodynamic food growing, versus wine grapes. The main thing with biodynamic is that it's supposed to be a closed loop system. So that means that anything that's brought on the farm is utilized and little is brought into the system. So that is sort of one could say is the ethos of organic as well. But because the law was written as an input output situation where it's like, these are the things you're allowed in to use on organic farm or in organic processing, these are the things you're not. That means that the whole system for organic is now regulated by those inputs. For biodynamic, which doesn't have the same federal oversight, the system is much more about the practices that you use and using everything on farm. Like I said, that is still the goal of organic, but because the law was written in a certain way, it isn't always played out that way.
Mm-hmm. Gotcha.
And we also, if listeners are interested in more information about wine specifically, there's that episode that Jenny mentioned. We interviewed Zwan Grays, who's the wine director at Olmsted, and did a pretty deep dive into harvesting wine by moonlight on a certain cycle of the moon, because that's when the grapes. I don't know. Anyway, it was a cool episode. So check that one out.
One last thing on that point. People often say that biodynamic is hokey, and my response, and I've gotten known to get a little upset about this, is that if you think that the tides are hokey, that the tides coming in and out by the moon is hokey, then sure, you could think biodynamic is hokey. But if you know that the tides moving in and out by the cycles of the moon is pure science, which it is, then biodynamic isn't hokey. So that's sort of how I try and describe it.
I feel like I'm being called out for making fun of picking grapes by the moon cycle.
Yeah, this is like the most common. I had this conversation last week many times during and after our wine event, because we had the exact same conversation. And I think it's just something about the moon, and there's parts about burying different rams' body parts, and there's all this stuff in biodynamic that sounds kind of nuts to us, but a lot of it's been practiced for centuries, and so it kind of, for me at least, like, no pun intended, like, brings me back to earth when I think about this is so like science based and biodynamic is so hokey, but that's just really not the case.
Let's pivot to talk about Pineapple Collaborative a little bit. Tell us kind of big picture what you're hoping to accomplish, or what change you want to see in food systems in general through your work with Pineapple.
Definitely. So we have a lot of goals. I think generally speaking, we exist as a company to create community for women who love food and to highlight and empower women across the food world, but also, like I said, women who just are interested in food. So we did start as a sort of industry-based organization, but we quickly realized that there was opportunity to broaden that, because so many women connect to food in some way, whether that be a positive or negative relationship. There's some connection to food that they feel, whether it's personal through family or their work, or they just love going out and eating. What we try and do is we bring all these women together to sort of dive a little bit deeper and talk about these issues in a more sort of nuanced, interdisciplinary way, like I was talking about before. And really the goal of all of that is to push the women in our audience and to push all women who care about food to think a little bit more critically about where their food's coming from, where they're eating, and why. So are you shopping at women-owned businesses? Are you supporting women of color businesses? Are you knowing where your food comes from? Are you talking to your farmers about your hog casing? I mean, really, these are all of the pieces that we're looking and excited about getting our audience interested in. And so we often hook people in by a beautiful brand and really interesting online content. But then if you sort of look a little closer, most of our content and questions at our events are really, really deeply rooted in food systems change. And that's a big part of my role, is making sure that we're sort of, every event we have, we're always asking sort of hard-hitting questions. We're not just having a fun conversation about baking, but we're having a conversation about where their flour comes from.
I'm part of a couple of women's food groups, and I think, or food, also women in tech groups, and I think everybody kind of has a slightly different take on, like, should there be men allowed in, like, women-forward groups as allies? If so, like, why or why not?
Yeah.
But also, there has been a group, or several groups, that have been sued by men for being too exclusive because they're supposed to be women forward. Like, what are your thoughts on, you know, creating a community that is very much needed, I think, for women in any industry, but also balancing kind of like the legal precautions of that?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, we talk about this a lot. Our events are open to men. We are geared towards women and we are for women, but I'd say about 10% of our audience is men. And we have certain events where there are zero men, and we have certain events where there are a few or a handful. It's always interesting to sort of watch them squirm because they've never been in a space where there's so many women, which I think for a lot of women is normal for us to be in spaces where are mostly men. But yeah. I think the challenge is that, you know, we've gotten feedback from some of our audience saying, you know, I love being inclusive and all, but it's way better when there are no men. And, but we think, you know, in the end, if you are supportive of women and you want to highlight really awesome women that are doing really important work in the food system and in our food world in general, then you should be allowed to come to our events. You should definitely read our newsletter. You should listen to our podcast. You should get involved and support what's happening across our food system and our food industry, which is women are here and we're not going anywhere.
And Pineapple also takes a pretty expansive understanding of the word women or definition. Yeah. Would you talk us through that a little bit?
Yeah. So, you know, we do say we are for women, but we have a sort of a mission statement, or it's not a disclaimer, but a sort of piece of text at the bottom of all of our work that talks about that anyone is welcome. And that means all genders. That's all races, all creeds, all ages. We have policies for women bringing their children. We have work trade opportunities. We have volunteer opportunities. And all of that is to say that yes, we are for women, but we really believe in inclusivity, and with that has to come opportunity for others to get involved and for everyone to be involved.
We wind up talking to a lot of entrepreneurs, and you know, our podcast sometimes becomes a sort of mini how I built this. So can you take us through the business model? How does Pineapple support itself, and where is it going?
Yeah. So first, before I get there, I got involved with Pineapple about a year and a half ago. The founders, they were based in DC. I had known one of them from when I lived there in the food world. And so they sort of asked me to jump on board. So when it comes to how I built this piece, I was not there from the beginning, but have definitely been part of the sort of second phase, which has really been the part where we are building out our model. You know, our revenue stream is mostly from events and from fiscal sponsors. So we sort of act like we work with organizations or companies, to talk about them and to highlight our partnerships with them. And we have a few other things in the works, which we can chat about another time, about other ways that Pineapple will be making income in the future. But there's, you know, I think right now we feel like it's most important to be building our business and our community as lean as humanly possible. You know, as of now, we have not taken any investor money. That's something that we're, of course, in conversation about. But right now, we're really focusing in on our mission and the work, the daily work.
Why is it important that you haven't taken any? My company is in a similar position, but I'm really interested to hear your answer.
So complicated. I think that
we'll ask this in the last 9 minutes.
Yeah, right. Come on.
Do a whole show just on this.
All right. I think that for us, we really wanted to sort of see what the first year plus could look like. And, you know, Pineapple has been around since 2015, but as its current stage of business and the way we're working has really been the last year and a half or so. And so I think we wanted to see how we could support ourselves and support the business without taking on any investment. You guys actually had Agatha and Aaron from Ovenly on recently, and I don't know Erin as well, but Agatha is a total shiro for me, a total mentor. And we've had a lot of conversations about the importance of the types of investors you're bringing on. And I don't want to say she scared me, but definitely has made me think seriously about the way that we're bringing investment on. And I think that, I know that they actually talked about that a lot in the podcast with you guys just a few weeks ago. But I think that ensuring that the type of investment we are getting aligns with our values, because our business is so value driven, is priority number one.
Yeah, it's tricky. Let's talk in the last few minutes about your, it's a funny word, but I guess your lifestyle. You're a freelancer, which is something that it feels like in the food space, especially in the New York and the Brooklyn food space, there's a lot of people who call themselves freelancers, who want to be freelancers. I don't know that I've met a whole lot of people who do it as successfully or as diversely as you do. So I guess what I'm asking is that really hard? No, I mean, like, how does that work? How do you make it work?
Yeah. I mean, it started, like I said, it started out of this idea that the only way I was going to be able to make an effect change was to understand as many aspects of the food system as possible. So that was sort of the impetus. I also couldn't sit at a desk for 8 to 10 hours a day. And so that was a problem. Way too like jittery. So I had to find a new way. But the main thing is how I'm making it work right now is I pretty much always have a project that is steady. So that I work on for over a year. Sometimes it's been 2 years, that I know where some income is coming from, and then I'm able to add on other projects. I find that that allows me to ensure that I can pay my rent. But again, the freelance lifestyle and the contracting lifestyle is, it's a decision that stressful. Should be thought through. Yeah. It can be stressful. The way I've done it, like I said, I really make sure that I have these steady projects. So like I rarely take something on that's going to be super short term, because it does make me stress. Like I don't want to have a situation where I'm working on a project for 10 hours and I spend all this time, writing a proposal and then I do the 10 hours and it's over. I really like to dig my feet in. So while it is technically freelance, it's almost more like contracting on a few projects that are across this breadth that I've been able to develop. I will say that this is not for everyone, and it's really important for people to think about what works for them, because this requires a lot of networking. It requires a lot of going to events and talking to people and having no shame and really feeling like you can engage with anyone. I will say that's advice for any human being, but it's particularly true when it comes to this type of work. And again, it really also depends on your financial situation. I have the privilege of having health insurance through my partner. Like that is one major way that I've been able to do this. Of course, I could buy health insurance, through other options. But I think that thinking through all of these ways that where money is coming in and going out as a freelancer is paramount.
Jenny, do you want to weigh in on this? I know you have some experience in this world.
Yeah, I mean, I think freelancing is one of those things that, if anything, has definitely made me check my privilege and realize that I'm lucky in what I have. I really echo the sentiment that you said, Haley. Like, I have health insurance through my husband. Because I had a very supportive in-laws, the first few years where I really was still building up my network and trying to get inbound inquiries, like, they helped me out money-wise and being able to invest money in like an SEO person for my website. There really is some truth in the like you have to spend money to make money, whether money in terms of time and energy at networking or money in like SEO practices. But there's a lot of like realizing that not everyone can do it, especially in different stages of life where they might have different like priorities and things that take precedent over, necessarily just doing what they want to do and feel passionate about. And for that, I feel fortunate and kind of like, sometimes I think at the beginning of my freelance career, I was a little bit more like spokesy, like everybody should just go out and do your passion. Like what's holding you back? And kind of realizing that there's like a lot of privilege wrapped up in that too.
Yeah. No, I think that's huge. I mean, like you said, this is like so DIY and like make your own adventure you have to be careful with the types of projects you take on and ensuring that you have that stability. Honestly, I still every day feel like should I be more specific about the projects I work on? You know, they do have a lot of breadth, but for me, it means that I get to work on so many different issues that I care about. And right now, I mean, yes, technically speaking, I am working on multiple projects, but most of my time is on Pineapple. And then the secondary is on the evaluation. And I've worked with my professor, who this evaluation is through, for 3 years on different evaluation projects. So I think it's finding those connections. And this is something that has happened to me across my career, is finding projects that might seem small. I know I mentioned, like, don't take that 10-hour project. I don't mean that. I mean looking at projects that allow you to get an in at a company or an organization. If you do a good job, most likely they'll lead to something bigger. And that's really been the way that I have engaged in the food system, is I often will work with someone in a smaller capacity, a few hours a week, but long term. And then a position comes up and all of a sudden, you know, I'm overseeing all of our cities at Pineapple. I mean, that's how it started. So I think there's real opportunity for, you know, understanding that these sort of smaller opportunities can lead to a lot more.
Well, Haley, it's been such a pleasure having you join us. It's over. I know. It always seems like we're gonna be able to talk forever, and then it's gone. Where can our listeners find you and find your work and find out more about Pineapple?
Yeah. So my personal account, which is mostly food and a good amount of my cat Carlos, is at Haley B. Barron on Instagram. And you can find us at Pineapple Collaborative as well. Definitely sign up for our newsletter. And if you're here in New York and you're looking for a really fun but sort of critical holiday event, we're going to be having a conversation on December 20th at Squarespace, where we're going to be sort of diving into what the real meaning of wellness is and sort of the co-opting of the word wellness, and having New Year's resolutions that maybe have mean nothing about change, but really more about loving yourself. So I'm really excited about the event, and hopefully I'll get to see lots of HRN folks there.
Yeah. And you can, as always, find out more about what we at the Why Food Podcast are up to on Instagram at Why Food Podcast. And on the Heritage Radio Network website, heritageradionetwork.org. And please email us with comments, thoughts, complaints, issues. You don't like my voice, whatever.
No complaints.
No complaints. Oh, yeah. Complaints you can send to a different email address, but compliments should come to whyfood@heritageradionetwork.org. You can find me via my spice company on Instagram at burlap and barrel.
You can always find me at Chef Jenny Dorsey, and you can thank our wonderful band, Red Cricket, for their theme song, Blind.
And as always, thanks to our kick-ass engineer, Matt Patterson, and we will see you next week.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.